The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the Elements section of the December 29, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker. The Elephantine Memories of Food-Caching Birds. Some animals can remember where they've buried hundreds of thousands of seeds. Why can't we remember where we've put our eyeglasses? By Matthew Hudson. A while ago, I searched for a beard trimmer in my bedroom. I spent probably 45 minutes looking in every likely location at least twice, and every unlikely location at least once. I swore up a storm. The trimmer never turned up. I've played similar games with pants. There's a reason for the burgeoning market in electronic tags that track your belongings. Our poor memories can seem mystifying, especially when you consider animals. This time of year, many species collect and cache food to stave off winter starvation, sometimes from pilfering competitors. So-called larder hoarders typically keep their troves in a single location. Last year, a California exterminator found 700 pounds of acorns in a client's wall deposited there by woodpeckers. In contrast, scatter hoarders, including some chickadees, jays, tits, titmice, nuthatches, and nutcrackers, distribute what they gather over a wide area. Gray squirrels use smell to help them find their buried acorns. But many scatter hoarders rely largely on spatial memory. People first noticed scatter hoarding by 1720 or even earlier. It's come under serious investigation, however, only in the past century. Scientists now know that birds' brains can contain elephantine powers of recollection. Some birds can store or cache tens or even hundreds of thousands of morsels in trees or in or on the ground and retrieve a good portion of them. In 1951, a Swedish ornithologist named P.O. Svanberg reported on Eurasian nutcrackers. Over the course of a single autumn, he saw each bird make some 8,000 caches. That winter, the birds dug through the snow to retrieve their stored food. Svanberg examined the excavation holes the birds had left behind and found nutshells in nearly 90% of them, an indication that there had been few fruitless efforts. In the late 1970s, researchers at Oxford buried sunflower seeds just 10 centimeters from where marsh tits had buried their own morsels. Over the following days, the bird-buried seeds disappeared significantly faster than those the scientists had buried, suggesting that the birds had precise memories of their cache locations. In 1992, other scientists reported that birds known as Clark's nutcrackers could recall, with better-than-chance accuracy, where they had buried seeds more than 9 months earlier. Vladimir Profosudov began studying food caching as an undergraduate at Leningrad, now St. Petersburg State University. "I'm a big believer in just watching animals," he told me. Above the Arctic Circle, he'd spend hours a day with binoculars and a stopwatch, observing willow and Siberian tits. He found that they could cache food as frequently as twice a minute. Extrapolating, he estimated that they could store as many as 500,000 bits of food each year. He grew fascinated with the question of how and why birds had evolved to be caching machines. Today, as a biologist at the University of Nevada, Reno, Profosudov focuses on chickadees. It's impossible to measure a wild bird's retrieval accuracy precisely. Among other things, there's no way of knowing when a bird looks in the wrong place before the right one. Still, every time I see them recovering, they look very purposeful, Profosudov said. When a chickadee retrieves a seed from bark or lichen, he noted, they don't search. They just go boom, and they just pull it out. When you see this, it is very, very impressive. All of which raises a question. If a bird can remember where it's placed thousands of seeds in the forest, why can't I find my pants? It would be good to know how birds evolve such extraordinary memories, so different from our own. To find out how natural selection may have forged birds' brains into steel traps, Pravosudov uses a unique piece of equipment called a feeder array, which his lab installs in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Each array comprises a square frame about 4 feet per side, which holds 8 automated feeders. Pravosudov's team catches chickadees in nets and straps tiny electronic tags to their legs. They then program the array so that only one feeder opens for each bird. Once a chickadee discovers its assigned feeder, the system can count how many incorrect feeders it tries per visit before hitting upon the correct one. The birds that make fewer mistakes are learning faster. The researchers make regular trips into the mountain range on snowmobiles to maintain the arrays. They use pulleys to suspend the apparatuses from trees in order to protect the birds from bears and squirrels. They adjust the height as snow accumulates under animals' paws. They've studied about 100 or 200 birds a year for the past 9 years and have found that the learning ability of first-year chickadees predicts whether the birds will live through their first winter, which is a big bottleneck for survival, Pravosudov said. Even small differences matter. In a study that was featured on the cover of Science this past September, the researchers showed that the worst-performing birds live for about a year on average, while the best performers survive to the age of 3. Memory appears to be shaped not only by natural selection, survival of the fittest, but also by sexual selection. Near the feeder arrays, Pravosudov's lab maintains more than 350 nest boxes, where researchers can monitor chickadee mating and reproduction. In a study published in 2019, they found that when females mated with males who had aced the memory test, they laid more eggs and raised larger broods than when they mated with those who had fumbled, a sign that the females were investing more in the reproductive encounter. They are somehow able to know something about the cognitive abilities of their male, Carrie Branch, the paper's primary author, who is now a professor at Western University in Ontario, told me. Branch thinks that the female birds pick up on a signal, perhaps song complexity or plumage color, which correlates with cognitive ability. The paper is titled, Smart is the New Sexy. Ultimately, food caching relies on spatial memory. This, in turn, depends on genes and the brain. Pravosudov has explored the genetic and brain mechanisms on which food caching depends. Research going back to at least 1966 has shown that damage to the hippocampus, a part of the brain involved in memory, hinders birds from returning to their caches. In the 1980s, scientists found that food caching species have larger hippocampi than other species. Pravosudov has extended these findings to incorporate the evolutionary pressure exerted by different environments. In 2002, he and his postdoctoral advisor, the comparative cognitive scientist Nicola Clayton, compared black-capped chickadees captured in Alaska with birds from Colorado, where winters are slightly less harsh. In the lab, the Alaskan birds outperformed the Coloradans, and their hippocampi were disproportionately larger and contained more neurons. In later studies, he and a postdoc, Timothy Roth, found similar neural patterns in birds from 10 North American locations with climates of varying harshness. London taxi drivers, who must memorize complex navigational routes, experience growth in areas of their hippocampi. That's a matter of training, not genes. Their brains have bulked up from use, like biceps. To better understand the significance of nature and nurture, Roth, Pravostudov, and their collaborators hand-raised black-capped chickadees, which they had plucked from nests in Alaska and Kansas. As before, Alaskan birds outperformed comparison birds on spatial memory tasks. Their hippocampi were the same size, but the Alaskan birds had more hippocampal neurons. In 2022, Branch, Pravosudov, and their colleagues managed to identify more than 200 genes associated with spatial cognitive performance, several of which were known to influence hippocampal development. Both genes and nurture, in short, played a role. The large-scale goal of all this work has been to demonstrate natural selection in action, a rare feat given the timescales on which evolution happens. Such a demonstration, Pravosudov told me, requires three interlocking elements. Scientists must identify variation in the wild, understand the trait or behavior's genetic basis, and show that it has consequences for survival or reproduction. Pravosudov believes that his lab is the only one currently capable of completing the jigsaw puzzle for cognitive rather than physical traits. Not just for birds, but for any animal. For this kind of work, he explained, chickadees in the Sierras are close to ideal. They're not migratory. They don't go anywhere. That allows for special access. We measure them every year. We know everything about their life. We know about their cognition, who they mate with, how many offspring they produce. Food-caching birds are a beautiful model to study, he said, because food-caching puts such enormous pressure on their cognition. The evolution of cognition by natural selection is a hotly debated question, Pravosudov pointed out. Some research suggests that performance on tests purporting to measure human general intelligence is roughly 50% genetically heritable. In 2021, 2 decades after the psychologist Steven Pinker published The Blank Slate, which explored the genetic basis of our behavior, Catherine Page Harden, a psychologist at the University of Texas at Austin, met criticism when her book, The Genetic Lottery, argued that DNA plays a powerful role in shaping socioeconomic outcomes. Beneath Harden's protestations that she's an egalitarian hides a stealthy affirmation of the old, tenacious view that races and classes are natural kinds, a biologist and a historian co-wrote in the New York Review of Books. Pravosudov tries to avoid such charged debates about IQ by sticking to memory. Memory is simple, right? He said. You remember or not. But intelligence, people don't know what it means. There's still so many biases. Whatever the trait, when studying natural selection, the bar for evidence is very high, he went on. That goes especially for plastic traits, such as aspects of cognition that can change over the course of a lifetime. When we say genetic effect, people think, oh, genetics determines precisely your cognition, Pravosudov said. No, it doesn't. But genetics provide the foundation on which you can build. A cheetah's swiftness is thrilling, but it is not surprising. Their bodies are clearly built for speed. The same goes for a bat's ability to avoid obstacles in the dark. It's noteworthy, but not surprising, because they have systems for echolocation. The feats of chickadees and other food-caching birds are especially impressive because they are accomplished through cognition. Dmitry Oronov, a neuroscientist at Columbia University, told me, Oronov's lab has discovered place cells, neurons that represent specific locations in the hippocampi of food-caching birds. When you look at a chickadee, it's mostly head, so it makes some sense, Carrie Branch said. Still, their abilities are startling, in part because we tend to think of memory as a largely human gift. And yet, chickadees may pay a price for their expansive spatial memories. In one study, Pravosudov's lab tested chickadees that resided at 2 different elevations, around 6,000 and 8,000 feet. Those at the higher elevation faced harsher winters and greater selection pressure to remember where they stashed food. As one would predict, the higher elevation birds made fewer errors after first learning which feeder in the array opened for them. But then Provosudov's team told that feeder to stop responding, so that the birds had to learn to visit a different one instead. This task, called reversal learning, is a measure of cognitive flexibility. You have to drop what you know and replace it with something else. Now, the higher elevation birds performed worse than the lower elevation birds. Their memory's grip was too tight. The higher elevation birds showed a greater amount of what's called proactive interference, a phenomenon well studied in humans in which learning one set of information can inhibit the learning of later information. Drilling one tennis swing, for instance, can mess you up when you try to make an adjustment. Another study, published last year, tested an even trickier problem, learning a rule. On each day, one of two feeders opened for a bird, and the assigned feeders flip-flopped daily. Success meant absorbing the abstract pattern and predicting which feeder would open the next day, a feat that may require not just associative learning, but executive functioning, which can include the abilities to assess a situation, make plans, and put them into action. Higher elevation birds failed to predict where the food would be each day, unlike some of the more forgetful birds from lower elevations. We think that high birds have such big and strong memories that they draw them back to the previous feeder no matter what, Provosudov said. Low elevation birds may not have this, and so that actually makes them smarter. Humans could probably benefit from remembering the locations of thousands of objects, but we get more value from cognitive flexibility and executive functioning. Our different brains reflect different evolutionary histories and allow us to approach survival differently. If you or I forget our car keys, we're not going to die of starvation, Nicola Clayton told me. We're probably got a mobile phone handy, and we can call a loved one or a friend and get things sorted and get back into the house and live for many more years thereafter. We did not evolve with mobile phones, of course, but we did evolve in an ecological niche that afforded us multiple ways of solving our problems. The pressures of natural selection rewarded us for navigating between them. I probably would not be able to remember all the locations that a chickadee remembers in the forest, Aronoff said. But, on the other hand, I remember so many facts and complex relationships between concepts. Using these, he can generalize, invent, imagine, and so on. Still, we might wonder if a person could have a memory a little more like a chickadee's. In a 1942 short story, Foon's The Memorious, Jorge Luis Borges imagined a man who, after falling from a horse and hitting his head, obtained infallible perception and memory. He knew by heart the forms of the southern clouds at dawn on the 30th of April, 1882, and could compare them in his memory with the mottled streaks on a book in Spanish binding he had only seen once, Borges wrote. The man complained, however, of having a memory like a garbage heap. He was almost incapable of ideas of a general platonic sort. It was difficult for him to comprehend that the generic symbol dog embraces so many unlike individuals of diverse size and form. It bothered him that the dog at 314, seen from the side, should have the same name as the dog at 315, seen from the front. Borges writes that his own face in the mirror, his own hands, surprised him every time he saw them. A condition called highly superior autobiographical memory, HSAM, approximates what Borges imagined. In 2006, researchers described a woman named Jill Price, who could recall in detail what had happened to her on any day after her 10th birthday, more or less. Price described having a split screen in her head, one playing the present and the other playing the past. It is nonstop, uncontrollable, and totally exhausting, she told researchers. Happy memories were pleasant, but others led to phobias, of bird droppings, for instance. The researchers reported that Price, although her general intelligence was not below the average range, had significant deficits in executive functions involving abstraction, self-generated organization, and mental control. Human memory, it seems, was never meant to be perfect and permanent. In a book entitled Forgetting, The Benefits of Not Remembering, the Columbia neurologist Scott A. Small suggests that the behavioral inflexibility seen in autism may result from genes that diminish forgetting. In a review paper, The Many Faces of Forgetting Toward a Constructive View of Forgetting in Everyday Life, the psychologists Jonathan Fawcett and Justin Hulbert list other documented benefits of forgetting: creativity, self-reinvention, mental clarity, big idea thinking, forgiveness, the updating of knowledge, and the reduction of post-traumatic stress. During sleep, they note, the brain prunes its neural connections. Machine learning researchers use similar tactics to push artificial neural networks away from the data on which they've trained and toward more useful generalizations. Some researchers have gone so far as to claim that forgetting is the default mode of the brain, Fawcett and Hulbert write. And yet, there may be commonalities between bird and human memory. In searching for my beard trimmer, I used so-called episodic memory, a kind of recollection comprising replayable experiences as opposed to facts, associations, or skills. Episodic memories have a what, a where, and a when. The last time I saw my beard trimmer, I was... Researchers debate the question of whether birds use episodic memories. Perhaps, instead of drawing on a simple list of locations, they see a tree and recall the time they stored a seed there. In the 1990s, Clayton conducted pioneering work that succeeded in demonstrating something like episodic memory in scrub jays. In a lab studies, birds prioritized the retrieval of freshly buried worms over peanuts. And then after 5 days, they switched to seeking peanuts. They seemed to know that certain locations contained worms that they had buried 5 days earlier, which would be rotten. They weren't relying on smell, as the food had been removed. In other words, they remembered not only where they had cached the food, but also what they had buried and when. Clayton's paper, published in Nature, described the finding as the first conclusive behavioral evidence of episodic-like memory in animals other than humans. Some researchers believe that episodic memory entails consciousness. How can a scene be reconstructed in memory if there is no one there to rewind and watch it? Clayton and Provosudov told me that they lean toward believing that birds have conscious awareness, although ultimately they leave the question to philosophers. Even if birds are conscious, though, I wouldn't want to remember like a bird. I prefer the special adaptations of human thinking. Adaptations that allow for language learning, empathy, and the ability to adjust and abstract. Survival for us goes far beyond collecting, hiding, and retrieving seeds. We must use tools. We must cooperate, and we must be able to change our beliefs. A mind like a steel trap would be nice, but I prefer one like a shopping cart. And now, from the Annals of Inquiry section of the January 5th, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, do insects feel pain? Insects make up about 40% of living species, and we tend to kill them without pause. New research explores the possibility that they are sentient. By Shayla Love. One of the stranger effects of Brexit was that, after the United Kingdom left the European Union in 2020, it no longer recognized animals as sentient beings. When the UK was part of the European Union, it was bound by European laws, including the Lisbon Treaty, which invoked sentience in order to shield animals from sensations such as pain, hunger, and fear. But after Brexit, the UK was no longer subject to the treaty. Numerous advocacy groups demanded a replacement animal sentience law. 29 leading veterinarians who treated cattle, birds, fish, dogs, and other animals sent a letter to the Daily Telegraph. Scientific evidence demonstrates the ability of animals across a range of species to have feelings, they wrote. We have fought for legislation that places a duty on the state to recognize this. In 2021, the UK government introduced a bill that covered only vertebrates, animals with backbones. More protests followed. 97% of animals, think clams, crabs, cicadas, are invertebrates. An octopus does not have a backbone, but in the Netflix documentary, My Octopus Teacher, from 2020, we see one that appears curious, uses shells as body armor, and seems to bond and play with a person. In the naturalist Cy Montgomery's nonfiction book, The Soul of an Octopus, she visits an octopus and observes that the animal had not only remembered us and recognized us, she had wanted to touch us again. And whatever happened to considering the lobster? The government asked Jonathan Birch, a philosopher at the London School of Economics, to lead an investigation into which animals should be considered sentient. Because scientists cannot ask an animal about its feelings, they tend to study whether it has a complex nervous system and if its behaviors suggest that it experiences pain and other sensations. Birch's team developed 8 criteria for sentience and collected research into whether various species met them. Crabs, for example, will groom injured parts of their bodies and endure a stronger electric shock in order to acquire better shells to live in. The team ultimately helped persuade the government to recognize sentience in cephalopod mollusks, such as octopuses and squid, and decapod crustaceans, which include crabs and lobsters. Even after the government passed the Animal Welfare Sentience Act of 2022, however, Birch felt unsettled. The new law made no mention of the most widespread animals on Earth, insects. Once you've got to that stage with octopuses, you very quickly start to wonder about other invertebrates as well, he told me. Insects make up about 40% of all living species. An estimated 1 trillion insects are farmed per year. Quadrillions are killed by pesticides, and many species have gone extinct as humans have cleared habitats for farms, factories, and cities. Most of us do not think much about their inner lives, and our laws do not usually consider their welfare. Insects are small, they don't scream or bleed red, and many are considered pests. We tend to kill or mutilate them without pause. The default view of the vast majority of the general public, as well as many of my colleagues, is that insects are largely reflex machines. Lars Chitka, a behavioral biologist who researches bees at Queen Mary University of London, told me. If humans seriously consider the possibility that insects are sentient, he said, we would need a completely different connection with the natural world. Several years ago, Tilda Gibbons, an early career scientist with shaggy blonde hair, came across an opening for a PhD student in Chitka's lab. As an undergraduate, she had studied chronic pain pathways, using mice as a model for humans, but she had never worked with insects. When she typed 4 words into Google, "Do insects feel pain?" the search engine suggested that the answer was no. Still, Gibbons was intrigued by the question, and she joined Chitka's team in the fall of 2019. A few months later, the UK went into a pandemic lockdown. When Queen Mary University closed its laboratories, Gibbons visited campus and picked up a cardboard box with about 100 bees. She carried it onto the London Underground and back to her apartment in East London, where she planned to study how machine-like bees really were. The box droned noisily next to her bed. Her cat examined it cautiously. "It kept me awake for the first few nights," Gibbons told me. "Then I just got used to it." Gibbons set up a plastic arena that contained two color-coded bee feeders. One feeder was room temperature. The other was heated to 130 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly the temperature of hot coffee. When she filled them both with the same sugar water, 4 parts sugar, 6 parts water, the bees reliably chose the cool one. When Gibbons reduced the sugar content in the cool feeder, however, the bees sought out the hot one. At first, the bees found ways to drink the sugar water without coming into direct contact with the hot feeder. "They were really cheeky," Gibbons said. But when she redesigned the feeders, forcing the bees to make contact with the heated surface if they wanted the liquid, they continued to choose the sweeter liquid in the heated feeders. The bees in Gibbons' experiment had satisfied at least one of the criteria developed for the Sentience Act. An animal may be sentient if it responds to motivational trade-offs. The bees reacted to heat in a way that was more than automatic. They put up with the heat to get a better reward. Gibbons was impressed. The other 7 criteria consider neurobiology and behavior. If an animal seeks out painkillers or can learn based on associations with painful stimuli, they can suggest sentience. So can nociceptors, nerve cells that sense harmful stimuli, especially if the nociceptors are integrated with other sensory systems in the brain. In 2022, Gibbons worked with Birch, Chitka, and other colleagues to review research into 6 orders of insects, including juvenile and adult cockroaches, termites, bees, ants, butterflies, and crickets. The literature showed insects to be far more sophisticated than one might expect of an automaton. Many have nociceptors that send signals to other parts of the insect brain, such as the central complex associated with spatial navigation and locomotion, and the mushroom bodies linked to learning, memory, and sensory integration. Cockroaches have a nervous system pathway that leads up from the body to the brain and back again. In a 2019 study, researchers exposed cockroaches to a hot stimulus and a neutral stimulus. The neutral stimulus prompted a weaker signal from the body to the brain, and the hot stimulus led the roaches to try and escape. Unsettlingly, cockroaches without heads responded to the heat but did not try to escape. A recent genomic study of mantises, which are notorious for eating their mates during and after sex, found genes that code for nociceptive ion channels, proteins that respond to pain. Gibbons and her colleagues ultimately found strong evidence for pain in adult flies, mosquitoes, cockroaches, and termites. Such insects did not appear to be at the bottom of a hierarchy of animals. They met 6 out of 8 criteria developed for the Sentience Act, which was more than crustaceans. Other insects, like bees and butterflies, met 3 to 4 of the criteria, showing substantial evidence for pain. "We found no good evidence that any insects failed a criterion," the researchers wrote. Pain is difficult to capture. Virginia Woolf observed that a person who falls in love can draw on the words of Shakespeare or Keats. "But let a sufferer try to describe a pain," she wrote, "and language at once runs dry." A physician might ask a patient to rate pain on a scale from 1 to 10, or to pick between illustrations of faces in progressively greater distress, or to select from the McGill Pain Questionnaire a list of 78 words such as tugging, sharp, and wretched. The pain of non-human animals is even further out of reach. René Descartes believed that it was not necessary to conceive of any vegetative or sensitive soul to explain the actions of non-human animals. In his view, they were stimulus response robots. In a Scientific American article from 1927, Harold Baston, a respected entomologist and photographer, reported that insects have sensory experiences that people cannot imagine. Ants, for example, can see ultraviolet light. Still, he wrote, we are faced by the extraordinary fact, attested by many students of insect psychology, that insects do not feel pain. He described gruesome experiments that appeared to prove the point. One cut away the front part of bumblebees' heads. The insects would still fly to flowers and try to feed. In another, a dragonfly that had had its abdomen amputated ate parts of its own body, and the, quote, food fell out of its gaping thorax. In 1964, Ruth Harrison challenged the idea that animals were machine-like in her book Animal Machines, which uncovered the horrors of factory farming. A decade later, Peter Singer provoked mainstream interest in the experience and subjectivity of non-human lives. Insects, however, are generally still seen as automatons. Singer wrote in 2017 that it was too soon to campaign for insect rights and that we should first give serious consideration to the interests of vertebrate animals, about whose capacity for suffering there is much less doubt. He has since signed in support of insect welfare declarations. One of the most influential papers on the subject, Do Insects Feel Pain?, was published in 1984 by C.H. Eisman, an Australian entomologist at the University of Queensland, and several co-authors. After surveying research into the neuroscience and behavior of insects, the authors wrote that insects were unlikely to feel pain, noting that their nervous systems are different from those of vertebrates. In some experiments, insects did not seem to respond to high temperatures, electrical shocks, or bodily harm. The paper, which has hundreds of citations in entomology, comparative cognition, and animal welfare and ethics, concluded that insects follow largely pre-programmed behavior patterns. It is only very recently that other scientific perspectives on insect pain have been considered. This year, Gibbons, Chitka, and their colleagues evaluated whether bees meet a sentience criterion called flexible self-protective behavior. When a person bumps her elbow, she might rub it and not her knee to try to ease the pain. Gibbons pressed hot and unheated probes to the antenna of various bees. A control group was not touched at all. She found that bees were more likely to groom antennas that had been touched by the hot probe. Gradually, her perspective on insects changed. Before she began studying them, she told me, she avoided killing bugs when she could, but she didn't give them much more thought than that. Lately, her research has prompted her to imagine what insects are experiencing. Maybe they were feeling something, Gibbons said. On a warm day last May, I met Sarah Skeels, a postdoc in Chitka's lab, in the lobby of the biology building at Queen Mary University. Her brown hair was pulled back into a ponytail, revealing a necklace shaped like a ginkgo leaf. She also had a bee necklace. Skeels was studying one of the most commonly farmed insects, crickets, and her colleagues had been studying black soldier flies and their larvae. We walked upstairs and into a small room with a red overhead light. Crickets are mostly nocturnal, and red lights, which they can't detect, minimize disruptions to their sleep cycle. Another student leaned over the crickets, which had small numbers glued to their backs. The student had touched one cricket with an unheated probe and would now watch its grooming behavior for 15 minutes. We watched the crickets silently for a minute or two, but did not see any grooming. In a different room, Skeels showed me a wooden box inside of which a homemade clear plastic tunnel forked in two directions. On one side, toward a yellow circle on the floor of the enclosure, and on the other, towards a purple one. The soft sound of chirping echoed around us. The yellow circle contained a well of sugar water and a piece of carrot, while the purple one did not. Skeels was trying to train the crickets to associate color with a reward. After that, SKILLS plan to test whether they, too, engage in motivational trade-offs by exposing themselves to heat for a better reward. As far as we know, every animal is capable of nociception, reflexive reactions to potentially harmful stimuli. When you touch a hot stove, the nerve cells in your fingertips send a signal up your spinal cord to your brain, which pulls your hand back before you feel anything at all. But this is different from a subjective feeling of pain, or of the more complex experience of suffering. Shelley Adamo, a professor in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Dalhousie University in Canada, is worried enough about the experiences of insects that, when she experiments on them, she first administers anesthesia. "All the behavioral work demonstrates the richness of the behavior," she told me. Still, she remained skeptical that insects with their small brains can be said to feel pain. The ability to have subjective experiences is likely to require additional neuronal resources, Adamo has written. Although the mushroom bodies in insect brains allow them to learn, Adamo does not see an analog for the amygdala, which is associated with emotional experiences in humans. Insect brains are not going to have the same depth and the same sort of cognitive components and all of the things that make pain so horrific in humans, she said. What would be the use of pain for a cricket? Chitka has argued that a small brain doesn't necessarily mean a lacking one. No one would seriously suggest that a bigger computer is automatically a better computer, he has written. Andrew Barron, a comparative neurobiologist, and Colin Klein, a philosopher, have compared insect brains to human brains and concluded that some regions could facilitate a subjective experience. They define subjectivity in a generous way, as a minimal level of bodily sensation or something resembling an awareness of the environment, which doesn't necessarily come with higher order thoughts. Klein believes that insects probably experience rudimentary sensations like hunger and thirst, which drive them to seek out food and water. Pain could be a comparable sensory experience that helps an insect to avoid harm. But he acknowledged that humans may never know how much of the animal kingdom can be said to experience suffering. Birch, the LSE philosopher, likes to visit the China and South Asia room of the British Museum. When I met him there last spring, he showed me the Indus Valley seals, which date to around 2000 BCE and depict animal figures, rhinoceroses, elephants, bulls, and what looks like a unicorn, on soapstone tiles. They show that there's a 4,000-year history of relating to animals in complex and interesting ways, he told me. In Birch's view, it's the early modern period of Western culture that's an anomaly. We got it into our heads that other animals were not sentient, he said. We moved on to the artifacts of Jainism, a religion that extends sentience to all living things, including plants and microbes. Jains grapple with the destructive impact of everyday actions on other life forms. Their answer has been to reduce harm as much as possible through ahimsa, nonviolence. When contemplating insect pain, it's hard not to feel crushed by the ethical implications. Recently, I was visiting Miami and a massive water bug crawled out of a vent in a bathroom. My first instinct was to smash it quickly. But I found myself hesitating at the thought that it might suffer. I tiptoed out of the room. Later, my boyfriend captured it and released it outside. The idea of insect welfare may be inherently less relatable than the idea that furry mammals or tuneful birds should be shielded from suffering, and the practicalities can be grim. One of Birch's collaborators, an entomologist at Indiana University at Indianapolis, named Megan Barrett, considers how we ought to act toward insects given the concern that they might suffer. last year, Barrett, slim and commanding, presented data at a London workshop on the treatment of farmed insects. She said that preliminary findings suggest black soldier flies prefer molasses, which may help them produce more eggs than water alone can. An example of welfare considerations that align with the goals of farming. Larvae are a common protein source for livestock and pets. She also spoke bluntly about how larvae are killed in microwaves and ovens, for example, or by grinding, boiling, or freezing. A larva may survive for more than a minute in a hot oven, she said disapprovingly. My breakfast turned in my stomach as she showed slides of ground larvae. Larvae can have one of two experiences going through a grinder, she said. Depending on the size of holes in its metal plates, they can be killed immediately or get stuck. Her recommendation, to minimize their potential suffering, was to put pieces of a potato through the grinder to push the remaining larvae through. Barrett cited a 2021 survey of American adults, which found that 52 to 65% supported the notion that insects such as honeybees, ants, and termites were capable of feeling pain. She did not say outright that she agreed. Neither did any of the scientists or philosophers I spoke to. But she argues that the idea's plausibility should push us toward new ways of farming, studying, and managing insects, just as concerns about farm animals have gradually pushed society toward more humane practices. When Barrett was asked in a recent podcast interview whether insects are sentient, she said, "I think it's likely enough that I've changed my whole career based on it." This past April, Chitka visited New York for a conference on animal consciousness at New York University. A group of biologists and philosophers, including Birch, released what they call the New York Declaration on Animal Consciousness. It argued that, based on current evidence, there is at least a realistic possibility of conscious experience in all vertebrates and many invertebrates, including bees and fruit flies. The declaration was both radical and cautious. In response to a news headline about the event, "Insects and Other Animals Have Consciousness," experts declare, Anil Seth, a neuroscientist and one of the signers, quickly posted an objection on X. "The headline is all wrong," he wrote. "I signed the declaration precisely because it did not declare which other animals have consciousness, but spoke in terms of realistic possibilities of conscious experience." I met up with Chitka on a rainy morning at Washington Square Park in Lower Manhattan. When I sent him a message to say that I was running late, he replied, "No worries, I'm here now looking at flowers to look for bees." I found him in a planter, peering up at a tree. He looked very much the part of the field entomologist. On top of his shoulder-length hair was a black trapper hat with the sides pinned up. "Honeybees prefer warmer weather," he told me, "but bumblebees wouldn't mind a chill." We examined the flowers around our feet and slowly began to circle the park. There were no insects in sight. Chitka was initially interested in bee cognition, not insect pain or welfare. He found that bees could count, recognize images of faces, and learn how to use tools from other bees. After decades of study, his conclusion is that if they're smart enough for all those things, they probably have more complex lives than we give them credit for, including the capacity to feel pain. In his spare time, he plays in a band called the Killer Bee Queens. One of their songs, "The Beekeeper Dream," references how honeybees can recognize different human faces. Still, on our walk, Chitka seemed to accept that a growing body of scientific evidence would not quiet every doubt, that he might be looking for something that he would never find. "There isn't any way in any creature to formally quantify or prove pain," he told me. "What we're trying to do instead is add up evidence from very different lines of investigation and see what's the probability." The rain slowed to a fine mist, and we sat down on a damp bench. "It's scary, but in a sense also fascinating for me, that we are surrounded by all kinds of creatures that are sentient, Chitka said. There were almost no people in the park that morning, given how dreary it was. Still, as he spoke, I thought of the bees and moths and flies and roaches that were somewhere around us, and the empty park seemed to populate around me. I couldn't be sure of what, if anything, pain or pleasure might mean to them, but I had the feeling that we were not alone. And now from the Talk to the Town section of the January 6, 2025 issue of the New Yorker. As if times weren't unsettling enough, Saturn is losing its rings. The rain, it raineth every day, as Shakespeare noted, apparently even on Saturn. The cosmos, it seemed, is no comfort at this moment, by Adam Gopnik. If anything seemed solid in a melting and mutable world, surely it was the great big outer planets of the solar system. There they were, Saturn and Jupiter, stately, if a little foreboding, hanging around close together, impossibly large and bright, in the Great Conjunction, as it was called, visible for the first time in decades 4 winters ago in the pandemic year of 2020. You could go outside then and stare at the gassy planets on the empty streets at midnight, their presence suggesting, if not a benign purpose, then at least a superintending one, the permanence of the cosmos itself, while we chafed and fretted below. But now news has leaked out. It has been known to astronomers for a while, but only recently reached our shared night sky gazers' consciousness, that Saturn's beautiful rings, the one true ornamental element in the solar system, was vanishing. Ring rain, it seems, is wasting them away in what is, for a cosmic event, a quick process. Ring rain is just what it sounds like, charged water particles leaking out of Saturn's rings and raining down onto the planet, diminishing the rings at what astronomers say is an alarming pace. Saturn is losing its rings at worst-case scenario rate, an article published by NASA read, and a science website bid goodbye to Saturn's rings. Though the farewell taps will be heard for some time, since that worst case turns out to be about 100 million years, not exactly what we mean by worst case scenarios down here on Earth, where they tend to entail 4-year cycles, if that. The causes and consequences of ring rain are fascinating, if still a bit obscure to the non-astronomer, because they involve a complicated exchange between the surprisingly fragile ring system, first spotted by Galileo himself back in the early 17th century, and the planet. For all the ring's majesty and beauty, they're mostly ice mixed with rocks. At times, ring particles take on an electric charge, from the sun's ultraviolet light, for instance. When this happens, they're more susceptible to Saturn's gravitational pull and begin pelting into the planet's atmosphere. If that thought isn't alarming enough, add to it that in 2025, we will be able to see what it will look like when Saturn's rings are gone. That's because, in the coming year, Saturn will tilt in a way that, from the point of view of Earthlings, creates a startling trick of eye and angle that makes the rings invisible. We will be able to look 100 million years ahead, at least for a while. The rings should be back in sight in the next couple of years, or at any rate, let's hope so. One of the emerging truths of the cosmos is that some of the same laws of slow contingency and evolutionary drift, of vertiginously changing vantage points, oscillating with incremental processes that govern our paltry lives, also affect the large stuff out there. What we see when we look up, like what we see when we look around, is not a well-ordered clockwork kicking its way toward eternity. It is a mix of short-lived illusions, long-lived evolutions, meaningless overlays. The constellations we love, after all, are just superimposed serendipities, stars at vastly different distances seen as one, lucky accidents and unforeseen developments. Some comfort can be found in the indifference of the cosmos to our stories. Some other comfort lies in the thought that the cosmos tells stories much like our own. It may turn out, for instance, that, as the physicist Lee Smolin has theorized, our universe has evolved on a Darwinian basis. Just as humans outcompete other creatures in the struggle for existence, some kinds of universes have outcompeted other kinds in the struggle for cosmological existence. Our universe, in this view, is a kind of successful predatory cosmos. It's one that worked. After all, if we see a lion dining on a zebra, we can be sure that there were previous lions who dined on lots more zebras than other lions did to give birth to this particular one. So it is, it would appear, with the universe itself. Its existence is proof of the success of this precise kind of universe in the struggle for existence with other alternate universes. And then let's add to this confounding catalog the truth that looking up at the night sky for comfort seems a little more implausible right now. As everyone knows, people in the neighboring state of New Jersey, right across the Hudson, have been spotting ominous squadrons of alien drones, or far more likely spotting not ominous drones, but familiar assortments of normal drones and passing airplanes and helicopters, and even planets and stars that some people have spent too much time watching Fox News to have noticed before. It is beyond strange that New Jersey was the site of another American panic to take place under uncertain skies in a deeply divided time, filled with looming fears of approaching fascism and America First ideology. The earlier incident was a result of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds radio play in 1938, which sent New Jerseyans, and not just New Jerseyans, racing into the streets in fear of an alien visitation. The reversal, perhaps typical of our time, is that whereas the Welles broadcast was a program that heard indoors, thrust people into terror out of doors, our drone panic involves an outdoor occurrence that people race inside to make sense of, or rather, not to make sense of, with YouTube videos and social media amplifying rather than easing the panic. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.